Justice for Germans, in conjunction with Volksfront Media, presents Eisenhower's Death Camps. After World War II, the focus on historical research, inquiring into German war crimes, may have ultimately been caused by the lack of concrete documentation showing the violations of international law committed by the Allies. It must therefore become the responsibility of historical science to shed light upon this undoubtedly uncomfortable chapter of history and to determine in what situations which crimes against humanity were perpetrated and to establish a prerequisite for better compliance with the norms of human rights in warfare. In view of the May 8th celebration in the world and the assertion of an alleged liberation of Germany in 1945, it is the duty of every loyal German to show the other side of the coin. Namely, that in 1945, the Allies liberated millions of Germans, indeed, liberated them from their property, from their homeland, and from their lives. At the end of the war, roughly 11 million German soldiers were in the hands of the Allies. Of those, approximately 8 million in the custody of the British and the Americans. This film addresses the so-called Rhine Meadows camps. We loyal Germans do not celebrate an alleged liberation on May 8th. Instead, on this day, we mourn the German victims who were exterminated after the war by starvation, hypothermia, and other methods of murder. When the Hague Conventions on Land Warfare were formulated at the beginning of the 20th century, the participating countries agreed to subjugate their nations to international law. This new body of law was, amongst other things, meant to humanize warfare, meaning that, for example, violence against defenseless human beings such as prisoners of war would be prohibited. On January 26, 1910, the Hague Ground Warfare Rules were ratified by the attending countries, which included Germany, England, France, and the USA. With regard to the treatment of prisoners of war, the following was established as law under Article 7 of the Hague Land Warfare Rules. The government in charge of the prisoners of war is required to provide for the welfare of their prisoners, and in the absence of any special agreement between the warring countries, the prisoners of war are to be treated equally to the troops that took them into custody regarding the nourishment, accommodation, and clothing. On July 27, 1929, the protective provisions of the Geneva Convention, which were formerly only granted to the wounded in war, were also extended to all prisoners of war. It was determined that, henceforth, prisoners are to be treated equally in every respect and on par with the victor's own troops. In March 1945, the Americans cross the Rhine. 6 million German soldiers are taken prisoner. On one day alone, a group totaling 300,000 surrendered. For them, the war was over. The losers can only hope for humane treatment. But their worst nightmare had just begun. At first, I was happy to be in the West, because we all thought, if we're taken prisoner, we'll be better off with the Americans. And so I surrendered, with the hope of humane treatment.
hier eine humane Behandlung erleben zu
können. I had no idea what the next 5 months would bring and how disappointed we would become. You arrived in Remagen and were led through the gates of the camp, or driven through it, and then put into your quarters? Would you care to describe for us what that looked like?
Well,
the way you described it, it almost sounds as if I was arriving at a nice vacation retreat. But the reality was quite different. The horrors began already in Niederbreisig, and then also in Remagen, in the same way, with an enormous shock. We were chased off of the trucks, and then we saw the alley, the gauntlet alley, which the American soldiers formed all the way to the gate with two rows, armed with wooden boards, chasing us through the gauntlet with these boards.
Come on, let's go.
All was hitting us across the lower back. And this was really an experience which I thought was just not possible. I was thinking then, if soldiers are capable of doing this to other soldiers, then we can expect them to do just about anything to us. Above all, prisoners are supposed to be under the observation of the International Red Cross. And after the conclusion of the conflict, all prisoners are to be released as soon as possible. This addition to the Geneva Convention was also signed by the so-called Liberators of 1945. In 1943, however, the Allies agreed in secret to designate the German soldiers not as prisoners of war, but as criminals, in total disregard of international law. The high command of the respective Allied forces were thus free to handle the prisoners as they pleased. In this respect, the Supreme Commander of the Allied forces, the future President, Dwight David Eisenhower, received on March 10, 1945, the authorization from Washington not to release the German prisoners of war held on German ground, but rather to keep them imprisoned as so-called disarmed enemy forces. As a result, the prisoners had no protection under international law and were abandoned to the machinations of the victors. After crossing the Rhine in March of 1945, Americans decided that they did not want to bring the German prisoners of war to the camps which had already been prepared for them in northern France. Instead, by order of Eisenhower, they settled the prisoners of war in the farm fields along the western shore of the Rhine River. Of the 188 American prison camps, dozens were located along the Rhine River and the adjacent wide-open areas. These so-called Rhine Meadows camps stretched from Remagen across Mainz to Bad Kreuznach and all the way across Ludwigshafen. Other camps were frequently dismantled after a while, and the occupants then transferred to the Rhine Meadows camps. At the end of the war, the surrendering soldiers were detained at various battle locations. But also taken into captivity were an unknown number of old men and youths belonging to the Volkssturm, which were civilians in uniform, for example, firemen, National Socialist Party officials, and ordinary civilian members of the party. Furthermore, injured soldiers on leave were rounded up from the hospitals, female support staff and intelligence personnel, and sometimes even youths, those deemed old enough to hold a weapon, were also taken into custody. The reasons for these breaches of international law and of inhumane treatment cannot be seen as anything other than a determined effort to take the greatest possible number of Germans as prisoners. What happened to the prisoners as they were taken into custody and immediately thereafter was often unpredictable and random. The prisoners were forced onto trucks. They had no idea where they would be taken. one such transport would become a trip of death. We had to stand very close together. They drove very crazily. And suddenly, we were tossed about when the truck rounded a curve in the road, and about 30 men fell off the truck, and half of them were killed. Sometimes a comrade would yell when there were apple trees along the road with branches overhead, so that we could duck down. The guy who was in front of me didn't react fast enough. Moving at 60 kilometers an hour, the branch hit him directly in the forehead. He began to collapse, but there was really no place to fall down. As he slowly sank down, his head came to rest between my legs. His skull was cracked wide open. He was finished. The trucks would arrive at the entrance, and the gate would be open, with lots of commotion, screaming and shouting, and the prisoners were driven out, being smacked with batons. And my first impression was that we were now like farm animals going into a slaughterhouse. It was really horrible, as everyone tried to run and duck. And it was especially bad for the amputees, some of whom had lost their prosthesis and were then even beaten with their wooden limbs. Without any regard to uniform, rank, or age, everyone was driven into the cages. We certainly didn't expect to be loved, and we had no expectation that they would be very gentle either. Laverne Keats, former guard at the Remagen camp, remembers how it was. We were all very concerned and worried. I had heard about the Volksturm and the so-called werewolf groups, and so we had to protect ourselves. We were rough with them. We rounded up everybody and brought them all into the camps. The Americans are obviously not prepared to deal with the swelling numbers of prisoners. A dog in a doghouse would have had it better. He's got shelter, a roof over his head. He has maybe some hay. The fact is that for whatever reason, however they justified it to themselves, we were handled worse than animals. The conditions quickly become a living hell. No, we didn't even know where we were going, or even what our job was. We didn't even know who was in charge. There was no organization whatsoever. We had no equipment and no shelter for the prisoners. And it was cold in April. It was really bad. In many camps, from the start, the prisoners received no sort of care whatsoever. In the first few days, we received nothing to eat or drink. And for the first time in my life, I had to experience men drinking their own urine. I even ate grass, like the others, but the human digestive system is not meant for that. To my understanding, it was because the German civilians and the refugees had so little to eat that Eisenhower did not want to feed the soldiers any better than the civilian population, that he was worried about the overall food supply for the coming fall and winter of 1945. But that was a big lie. The civilians were being systematically starved under the Morgenthau Plan. It is impossible to determine the exact numbers of prisoners in the camps, since the Americans deliberately failed to register them. Only in isolated cases were the incoming and outgoing numbers actually counted. The International Red Cross would have had the ability to take on this work, but they were denied access to the camps. It is estimated that between April and September of 1945, well over 5 million prisoners were detained in the Rhein-Meadows camps. The American GIs conducted themselves very harshly in an effort to convey to the German soldier that he was completely defeated. We have documentation of physical abuse in every form imaginable, with the intention to cause death both before and after the capitulation, with mock executions, nightly arrests of young boys who were dressed only in pajamas, but also, though less frequently, more correct behavior by the GIs, Independent of all this, most of the German soldiers claim that, after their capitulation, they had been repeatedly and systematically plundered by the American soldiers. The Americans stole their watches, their cameras, even their wedding bands. It is no wonder that, in bitter irony, the letters USA were translated into Army of Watch Thieves in the German language. The first thing was, I had to give up my watch. And the thought came over me, these rich Americans are going to steal our watches? That was pretty strange. But it was continuous. The luxury of having your own watch, which every German boy received for his Holy Communion or confirmation, was apparently not something the American soldiers had had. Additionally, the prisoners had to frequently give up their own personal belongings, including shaving utensils, mess kits, rain gear, and tarps. The camps. Most of the Rhein-Meadows camps were constructed for about 100,000 men. The actual camp was a large square open field surrounded by barbed wire fencing and divided into cages. Such cages usually had a length and width of about 800 square feet. Depending on the location, a cage held anywhere from 5,000 to 15,000 prisoners, divided into various groupings. The cages were patrolled from all sides, and at nighttime, floodlights were kept on. Those attempting to escape were subject to immediate execution, but occasionally, the guards would simply shoot into the masses for no apparent reason. After some months had passed, many of the prisoners were transferred to France. 10,000 of them were put to work clearing landmines, an often deadly mission. 1 million German soldiers are condemned to live here for many months at a time, cut off from the world in the open fields between Bad Kreuznach and Weser. For Hitler's former soldiers, the war is now over, and they just want to go home. The wait itself becomes a form of torture. But just how was one expected to survive in an empty, muddy field? I saw one comrade laying down in his hole. We had dug these holes about 6 feet long, 3 feet wide, 3 feet deep. It was a completely barren field, without shelter, not even a blanket, nothing. I said to this guy, what's with this hole? He said, well, another guy just died about an hour ago. You may as well take it before someone else does. Otherwise, you'll have to dig your own. So I said, okay, and I climbed into the hole. I thought, what the hell? What else is there? This is now your bed, your home. It's all you have. In order to protect themselves from the elements, the prisoners dug these holes with bare hands or empty tin cans. The fear of dying in there is always present. Down there it was warm. And at nighttime, because of the floodlights and all the noise, one couldn't sleep. But when the ground became wet, you'd be buried under an avalanche of mud weighing many hundreds of pounds. A comrade was hopelessly buried that way. There was no way that we could get him out. In other separate camps, hundreds of females were also held prisoner. Among them, Luftwaffe support worker Lotte Schutz. It was raining terribly. We were lucky and happy to have a warm coat. And after about 10 days, they brought us some tents, but only for the women. But the men had nothing. It was just horrible. Cold and rain set in and enveloped them. There were outbreaks of typhus and cholera. Simple holes in the ground were dug as latrines. Often they became death traps. Many of the prisoners fell in, and they were never helped. But then they sank down into the cesspit, and they were gone. Nobody did anything to help them. For the women, the situation was also a shameful nightmare. The worst part was at night, when we had to use those open latrines. But even during the day, and you had to go really badly, the Americans would stare, laugh, whistle, and make catcalls. It was awful. Panic and despair begin to set in. Even when food is offered, it is never enough. Soon, these former comrades were fighting each other. The lack of sleep, the permanent thirst, and the chronic hunger would bring a human being to behave like an animal. And it was just horrible. And later, even when the situation improved somewhat, and the first few came in with some hot soup, some of the men attacked them, punching them in the face. I can remember it so clearly now. In 1942 to 44, we saw the Russian prisoners as being subhuman, because they would even eat rats. Now for us, the situation was no different. The conditions, however, were not at all comparable. The hunger now is overwhelming, and so too begins theft. If someone was accused of theft and were caught stealing, they would hang a sign on them saying, "I stole from my comrades," and he was done for. Everyone would punch and beat him. They are now totally at the mercy of their captives and cut off from the rest of the world. Whoever is without friends is doomed. In order to improve their own chances for survival, small gangs began to form. The fear of death is overpowering, and their humanity falls by the wayside. They saw and experienced things that still torment the survivors. One guy said to me, "Please, I can't even stand up. I'm so sick." And he was very sick. So I went and got him his meal. And the people there gave it to me. They believed me. And he was so sick, spitting up blood, and eventually he died. But he slept beside me for 10 days like that, which was not good. Or very nice to be around. But I continued to get food for him until I personally couldn't stand it anymore and just had to move away from him, out of that hole. We were located in smaller camps. There were several camps with 70,000 prisoners on this one field, without a building, without a tent. Most of us were without a coat, sitting day and night in the mud, and we were totally full of lice. I myself had to stand in line for 14 hours, up to the ankles in mud, to get a tin can of water. Whoever could not hold out that long fell over and was counted to the dead, because no one would come to bring them any water. The security measures. The prisoners were usually guarded by second-rate soldiers, blacks or Polish reserve troops, and former foreign workers. These workers were commanded by other white soldiers. They were seen by the German prisoners as being extraordinarily brutal, arrogant, volatile, and aggressive. Roll call ended with beatings for those who had fallen over due to exhaustion. The soldiers of the Waffen-SS were treated with extreme cruelty, receiving long hours of punitive drills, and brutal beatings to the point of death were frequently observed. There was no respect or restraint in the treatment of high-ranking German officers either. American soldier Martin Breck tried to help. Whenever I would throw them food, the so-called K-rations, over the fence to the prisoners, they threatened me with court-martial, but I continued to do it. They warned me. They said, "Stop it. Don't give the prisoners any more food. That's all they're getting." But I did it, and I kept doing it. Those were rare moments of humanity that the prisoners greatly appreciated. It was a really nice warm day, and suddenly this American soldier nudged me from behind, and he shoved a package of concentrated food rations in my pants pocket. I will never forget that. In those moments, when you are alone and you come face to face with one of them, one had the chance to be seen and respected as being a human being. But in that crowd, never. The outrage is that the Americans deliberately killed hundreds of thousands and starved to death a large proportion of them, or caused them to die from exposure. The Russians also took prisoners, but they themselves were deprived, and so the prisoners suffered equally. The guards were not really much better off than their prisoners. The Russians really couldn't do any better because they didn't have the resources. But the Americans, and this is the outrage, they even turned away help from charities. And that was purely by intention and design. American investigations confirmed further war crimes. For example, 104 German prisoners of war suffocated in an American train transport. 24 others and 3 civilians were murdered at Tambach. And in Luxembourg, U.S. soldiers murdered 70 German prisoners of war. The living quarters. Daily, more men and women arrived from preliminary holding camps behind the front lines, locked in cattle cars and on trucks, and they were poured out of the trucks like trash into the cages behind the barbed wire. Some of the prisoners had already died during the transport. Life in the camps and the security and futures of these prisoners was determined by the temperament and mood of the local camp commander. Thus, it was a daily battle for personal survival. The prisoners lived through burning heat in the summer and sub-freezing temperatures in winter, on the bare ground, in fields which quickly turned into mud in the rain and the snow, without any shelter over their heads. And we just stood there on the field, and after 3 days, it was a wasteland of mud. I can't even remember now if it really was a meadow or a field. During the 4 months under the American command, each prisoner had roughly 8 to 10 square feet to himself. The prisoners had no tools or materials whatsoever with which to make their camps livable. The only possibility was getting a hold of some cardboard or using empty tin cans or cutlery for digging and to dig holes in the ground in which to live, which afforded some protection from the elements. Usually 3 to 5 prisoners shared one such hole in the ground, which was just large enough that they could lay in it sideways. The spring of 1945 was wet and cold. It rained and snowed off and on. The field turned into a wasteland of mud. Ernst Albrecht, then just 18 years of age, tried to protect himself from the elements. If we were lucky enough to get a hold of some tin cans, we would scrape out a hole the length and width of our bodies. If it was raining, we put the blankets over our heads and stayed that way until the blankets were soaked through. Starvation camp is what the prisoners called it. Often they had only a few crackers and dried beans. There was no access to drinking water. The digging of these holes was forbidden time and time again, and the prisoners were forced to close them back up, not just because the ground holes were dangerous, as the rainwater saturated them quickly and they collapsed, but occasionally they would send bulldozers through the camp to seal up the holes along with the inhabitants within them. Tents were never given out, even though there were plenty of them, in the depots of both the German and U.S. armies. About 40% of the prisoners lived like this in these dirt holes. Only about 5% were lucky enough to have a tent, and the rest of them camped out on the ground. We lived, and myself personally lived, for 4 weeks on the fields, others much longer. In the springtime, when, after a warm spell, there would follow the typical March-April weather, cold, damp, and rain. And since we could not sit down anywhere, we stood most of the time, or just walked back and forth. You didn't have any waterproof clothing, raincoats, tarps, etc., with which to protect yourselves from the rain? On average, I must say that most of them, although I cannot be absolutely certain, had nothing but their regular uniforms. They didn't even have overcoats because they were usually taken from them. There were a few who might have had a tarp, but really only very few. I myself, by sheer luck, received a good motorcycle jacket in the last few days of the war. But they took it from me when I was taken prisoner. But then I managed to steal it back from the heap of coats just as we were marched off. So in that regard, I was a little more fortunate than others. There was only mud. There was no dry place. And since there was only mud, we could only wander around, even at night. But at some point, sleep overcomes you. And so I closed up my coat on the top, just like a pair of pants with a band on the top, and I would let myself drop into the mud in the hope that I would be able to sleep for a few hours before my feet would begin to freeze. After much delay, we finally had one latrine in every cage. The longer the condition of starvation continued, the weaker the prisoners became. At first, men would help an ill comrade to the latrine, but later, they were all so weak that they just relieved themselves wherever they happened to be. We received some lime for the dead and for the latrine. The only problem was, if a completely exhausted man finally made it to the latrine to sit on the rail and, due to exhaustion, then fell backwards into it, he drowned. No one was capable of helping him. After a while, we were only able to crawl. We no longer had the strength even to stand up. There were so many of us like that. Who could possibly help anyone else? It took a long time to get a water station set up. Before that, the prisoners received water quotas. The water was taken unfiltered from the Rhine River or a nearby creek and then pumped full of chlorine to prevent epidemics. For a prisoner to get water, it usually meant that he had to stand in line for hours, even though he was already totally exhausted. Sometimes it took up to 10 hours to get a tin cup of water. Because of their great thirst, some of the prisoners drank from mud puddles, resulting in severe sickness. Their thirst was especially torturous in the summer months, when they were exposed to heat and sun without interruption. A person needs about 1,200 calories during rest, a working man between 2,000 and 3,000 calories per day. The prisoners in the Rhine Meadows in the months of April through July 1945 received only 400 to 900 calories per day. In many camps, they received no food at all on Sundays, and the new arrivals had to wait from 2 to 4 days before getting any food. And in this tin can, I had about this much of the food mash. Maybe you can appreciate what it means when I say that for 4 weeks I had no bowel movement. That's how little food I got. And when after 4 weeks I pressed out this hard black stuff, I passed out, and I would have almost drowned in that cesspool, just missing it by a hair's breadth. How many calories do you think you had every day? I've researched this, comparing it to the modern calorie tables. And I concluded that on this day, on this first day, which was relatively ample in comparison, we received, besides the two raw potatoes, perhaps 500 calories. With the potatoes, it then came to 700 calories. And if we found a fire to put the potatoes into some ashes, that helped. And how many calories does a man need basically to survive? 2,000. One possibility to get additional food would have been through support from the residents of the nearby villages. But the residents were forbidden under penalty of death to provide food to the prisoners. The German government was ordered to instruct their people accordingly. If anyone did try to take some food to the prisoners, he would be driven off or shot by the fence in front of the starving prisoners. There was no medical care in the beginning. and there was no medical equipment set up, and the Americans did not allow German doctors to practice, and if they did so anyways, then it was only from their own resources and without medications and equipment. They could only help with advice or to try to mitigate the pain. The International Red Cross, as mentioned, was not allowed access to the camps. Food and relief supplies, which the Red Cross transported on trains to the camps, were ordered to be returned by Allied Commander Eisenhower. Sick prisoners were not treated in the camps, but were only set aside by the Americans. We can assume that only 20% had a normal amount of food, and that 60% were starving, and 20% had so little food that they died. Camp Kreuznach, the so-called Field of Misery, had a hospital, but they only took patients that would be dead within 24 hours. During the whole imprisonment, the prisoners were under constant stress because they did not know what would happen to them or what was happening all around them politically. They had no idea as to what had happened to their families, and furthermore, they were forbidden to write to their relatives in order to give them a sign that they were still alive. The number of deceased and their fate. First, I need to say that there are no numbers available at all as to the suicides in various forms. Also, no numbers are available about prisoners who died due to the collapse of their foxholes caused by the inclement weather, or those who were bulldozed over, lying within those foxholes, and who then suffocated in the mud or in the cesspools, or those who died from their injuries. There was only one thing, the will to survive, to make it home someday, or, otherwise, to keel over and die. There are no established numbers of prisoners who died due to punitive measures taken against them, or who were already very close to death and who were sent to an evacuation hospital. Furthermore, there are no records of prisoners that were shot during cases of escapes, or of those who were shot indiscriminately day and night. It was frequently observed that prisoners had to take the clothes off the dead and remove their dog tags and load them onto trucks, which had an undetermined destination. A small number of the dead were buried in mass graves right beside the camp. Their clothes were then burned, and the dog tags had to be given to the Americans, who did not give them to the Red Cross, but deliberately melted them down. And here in this field that has since been built upon, you no longer see what really happened here with all the time that has passed. But here rest an unknown number, thousands of those poor individuals who had been penned in, out in the open, without water and food. In the camp Bretzenheim, for example, there were three variations of graves without names. There were graves for those who apparently aroused the anger of the guards. The next one was for those who, for some reason, resisted or who were shot during an escape. The third one was for those who fell into the cesspools or who had been shot in willful random shootings. According to the Americans, only 3,000 prisoners lost their lives at the Rhine-Meadows camps, which would be a ratio of not even 1 per 1,000. This data refers to persons who died of their illnesses or due to the refusal of help. Today we have, in a 12-month period, approximately 15 deaths per 10,000 people due to illness for people in the range of 20 to 40 years of age. In these cases, we can assume that these people had had enough food, clothing, a stable place to live, and medical care. Now, compare those to the prisoners who had almost no food and no medical care and who lived in open fields. Considering these environmental factors, these official numbers are nothing but a sick joke. The unbiased French-Canadian journalist, James Bach, in his book Other Losses, determined that the number of the dead to be over 1 million in the Rhine-Meadows camps. But where are these victims? In the areas around the former camps, tens of thousands lay buried, but not hundreds of thousands. Where did the U.S. Army trucks take all of these many corpses? Here, it is conspicuous that these U.S. trucks came fully loaded with provisions and supplies from the main supply center in Antwerp, and then returned there empty? No, full of German corpses. Only this would explain the fact that, in Belgium, there are a large number of unidentified corpses of German soldiers and civilians buried there, who could not possibly have fallen in battle during the comparatively short duration of those battles. The Belgian war cemeteries are full of unidentified corpses because their dog tags had been removed, and they were dumped like garbage left and right along the roadside in the woods on the way to Antwerp. Thus, we now accuse you as to this lie that we were somehow liberated from something horrible. The fact is, something horrible befell us. 7 million Germans lost their lives during the war. But now, please take note and remember this as the answer to those who would tell you lies. 12 million Germans were murdered after May 8, 1945, and the 1 million who were murdered here, not in meadows, but in the sludge and mud of farmlands, by starving them to death within only a few short months, also belong to this number. Tell us, what persuaded the Americans to incarcerate so many innocent people, and for another, to keep them locked up under the conditions presented here? Why were the prisoners not registered? What prevented the Allies from accepting German food supplies or to use the supplies offered by the Red Cross? Why were these deliberate policies of neglect put into place by the U.S. High Command? Why was it never permitted to give the dead in these mass graves along the line an honorable burial? In conclusion, it has been determined that the systematic murder of these German prisoners has received virtually no attention from the media, and that there is a great need for more detailed research. We hope that this documentary will contribute in a small way towards compiling the evidence of American war crimes. The goal of the victors was, and remains even today, the destruction of the German people. I walked down the Berkusenstrasse, I think it was on July the 15th, and I took a turn into the Eulerstrasse. This was my neighborhood. And as I came down the street, my mother sat in the bathroom crying. I was able to picture it exactly, because she did not even know if her son was still alive. And then the bell rang. And my mother washed her face, dried it off, hoping that the stranger at the door would not see that she'd been crying. Then she walked down the hallway to the door and opened it. And there I stood. And then my mother broke into tears. She was not even able to speak my name. And then only on perhaps the third attempt, she said, "My boy." And she took me into her arms. Truth is differentiated from half-truths in that it comprises the entire reality. That reality is that the years following May 8, 1945 was a period of absolute oppression of the German people. The experience of the Germans in the occupation zones of the Soviets, French, and Americans was absolutely horrible, and only slightly better in the British zone. After the 8th of May 1945, over 12 million Germans died as a result of crimes committed by the victorious Allies. Millions of German prisoners of war were murdered in cold blood in the Allied prison camps. A total of 16 million Germans were forced to flee from Eastern Germany and Eastern Europe, or were systematically driven out of their homes and off of their land. The most shocking part is perhaps the methods that were used to force them out. These expulsions were carried out with unimaginable cruelty. Millions of German citizens were murdered on the spot in their hometowns, or murdered as they tried to flee, or they simply did not survive the journey. Various causes of death were documented as beatings, summary execution, strangulation, drowning, stabbing, repeated rape, castration, crucifixion, whipping, and trampling, burned alive, mutilation, or being stuffed into drums and then pumping them full of sewage. During the Nuremberg show trials, the Soviet interrogating officers frequently had German prisoners of war tortured or shot if they did not admit to their alleged crimes. American and Jewish interrogators, in many cases, let their German prisoners starve for many days, poured feces over them, put sacks over their heads while beating them, in order to soften them up for interrogation. In the Malmedy trial, the accused German prisoners had wooden wedges driven underneath their fingernails or had their testicles crushed in order to force confessions. The U.S. military authority forbade the distribution of provisions and tents to prisoners that were available from the German and U.S. military depots, and they prohibited the giving of food and water to the German civilian population, and they ordered that civilian conscripts take food away and destroy it. The opinion that the Germans alone were responsible for the war, and therefore for the subsequent expulsion of ethnic Germans after 1945, is historically not supported by the facts. The causes of World War II started with European disagreements, which led to World War I, and then continued with the unmerciful actions of the victors to heap the sole responsibility for that war upon the German people, and then to plunder them. And it continued on to the Danzig Corridor dispute, and with the discrimination and persecution of the German minority in Poland. The suffering of 16 million German citizens driven off of their land and homes, the captivity of 11 million German men in death camps, and the deaths of well over 6 million German citizens following May 8, 1945, are far too significant to remain ignored, and they stand in stark contrast to those today who still believe that we Germans were liberated. Please stand with us and demand justice for Germans.
Today, I'm going to share some details about World War II that many of you might not have heard before. I base this information on the hundreds of hours of research that I have done. I base it also on an accurate knowledge of history, on evaluating both sides of an issue, and on my general observations, and last but not least, my common sense. Eisenhower's death camps. Usually when we see the words concentration camp, we naturally associate them with the highly publicized camps of Nazi Germany. Yet, the Nazis did not originate the calculated concentration of people for political, criminal, or cultural reasons. Establishment historians and others routinely conceal the utilization of the ongoing mass incarceration against America's indigenous population. In 1898, the U.S. military used what they called pacification camps in the Philippines. The British, with whom we have some sort of special relationship, used concentration camps to control the dissident civilians in South Africa during the Second Boer War between 1899 and 1902. Britain was attempting to seize their land and primary resources. The population limit of those camps was 117,871. Within 14 months, 20,117 people died. Dwight D. Eisenhower, a notorious womanizer, was friends with Roosevelt's daughter, Anna, who introduced him to her father. FDR and Eisenhower had similar worldviews, even from some of the same sources. Eisenhower, like Roosevelt, was a protege of Bernard Baruch, a very, very rich banker. Regarding his admiration for his mentor, on August 5, 1952, the Veterans of Foreign Wars awarded Eisenhower, then campaigning for the presidency, the very first Bernard Baruch Peace Medal. Why is it that war hawks always win peace medals? Eisenhower responded to the honor by saying, and I quote, "I was one of those who, for the past quarter century, has had the privilege of sitting at his feet," meaning Baruch, "and listening to his words of wisdom, words that still are mighty," unquote. In the same speech, he said that he endorsed the same policies that Baruch had been urging for years. After Eisenhower became president, he promoted many of Baruch's policies, including Baruch's United Nations plan for total disarmament, perhaps to accommodate the Cold War charade. That plan was actually a Rothschild plan. Disarming always leads to rearming, which always produces huge profits for the military-industrial complex. You know, the one that Eisenhower warned us about in 1961. In 1941, Eisenhower initially met Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's banker-assigned presidential handler. Hopkins may have influenced Roosevelt regarding Eisenhower's meteoric military career. Within a short time of meeting Hopkins, top military leaders closely associated with the White House promoted him over several better-qualified officers who actually outranked him. They elevated him to a full colonel in March 1941 and to brigadier general in September 1941. Keep in mind that this was before the attack on Pearl Harbor and before the U.S. entered the war. By February 1942, through the influence of General George Marshall, a Pilgrims Society member, they appointed Eisenhower to Assistant Chief of the War Plans Division. He helped plan the assaults against Japan and Germany. In March 1942, they appointed him as the Chief of Operations Division, War Department General Staff. In June 1942, they made him the Commanding General of the European Theater of Operations, stationed in London. Then, in his spectacular ascent, they advanced him to the position of Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force for the invasion of Europe, scheduled for December 1943. In February 1944, they designated him as the Supreme Allied Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force. In January 1943, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill had met in Casablanca to discuss Germany's unconditional surrender. This is an ominous term and a factor in total war, meaning a war where the aggressors target the entire population and a nation's non-military civilian infrastructure. Unconditional surrender includes total submissiveness after the battle and the complete eradication of the existing government. It also means relinquishing all treaty rights, such as the treatment of prisoners according to the Geneva Conventions. At the end of 1943, at the Soviet embassy in Tehran, Stalin and Roosevelt drank a toast to the deaths of 50,000 German officers who they laughingly thought that the Allies should immediately shoot at the conclusion of the war. In a letter to his wife, Eisenhower said, and this is a quote, "God, I hate the Germans. Why? Because the German is a beast," unquote. General Eisenhower, with the opening of the Ruhr operation, said, and I quote, "Our primary purpose is the destruction of as many Germans as possible. I expect to destroy every German west of the Rhine and within that area in which we are attacking," unquote. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr., who served as the Secretary of the Treasury from 1934 through 1945, worriedly told Roosevelt, and I quote, "No one is studying how to treat Germany roughly along the lines you wanted," unquote. Roosevelt said, and I quote, "We have got to be tough with Germany, and I mean the German people, not just the Nazis. We either have to castrate the German people, or you have got to treat them in such a manner that they can't just go on reproducing people who want to continue the way they have in the past," unquote. They need not have worried about who is going to implement the extermination plan. Eisenhower had said, referring to the Germans, that he wanted to, and I quote, "treat them rough," unquote. Ironically, the only premeditated mass extermination operation in Germany was the Morgenthau Plan, created by Secretary Morgenthau. It is rather curious that the Treasury Secretary would devise an extermination plan rather than the War Department. Even before the Normandy invasion on June 6, 1944, over a year before, by May 1943, with the Axis surrender at Tunis, Eisenhower had several hundred thousand German captives who the military transported in overcrowded boxcars to his camps. He wrote in a letter, and I quote, "It is a pity we could not have killed more," unquote. On February 24, 1944, he appointed his old, very discreet friend, General Everett S. Hughes, as his special assistant, his eyes and ears. He instructed Hughes, and I quote, "Emphasis will be placed on the consultative aspect of your duties rather than on the inspection aspect," unquote. In other words, he could influence policies but had no direct authority to make any decisions. Eisenhower was in charge of all policies, especially regarding the German prisoners. General Walter Bedell Smith, his chief of staff, had endorsed Hughes' abilities and perhaps his tendency towards unquestionable obedience to his superiors. Smith later became Truman's CIA director and helped devise the overthrows of Guatemala's President Arbenz and Iran's Mohammad Mossadegh, along with Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. On August 4, 1944, Eisenhower discussed prisoner rations with Hughes, who constantly reduced them below those set by the supply officers according to the provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Prerequisites Eisenhower had already dismissed before the war ended or before Germany even surrendered. On September 16, 1944, Churchill and Roosevelt agreed to implement the Morgenthau Plan, which included the complete destruction of German industry, another stipulation that was contrary to the Geneva Conventions. Eisenhower, probably for publicity reasons, something he did quite frequently, gave what is obviously a very hypocritical speech in March 1945, asserting that the U.S. would honor the Geneva Conventions with regard to humane treatment of all German prisoners. The U.S. had signed the conventions along with 46 other countries on July 27, 1929. Immediately thereafter, on March 10, 1945, Eisenhower quietly signed an order proposing, and I quote, "a startling departure from the Geneva Convention," unquote. He suggested a new class of prisoner, disarmed enemy forces, DEFs, prisoners the Army would not feed. Get that? They would not feed after Germany's surrender. Altogether, the Allies had between 7 and 8 million German prisoners. They captured 4.2 million before the new DEF status, similar to another type, surrendered enemy persons, SEFs. Author Giles McDonough writes that the latter captives, about 3 to 4 million, and I quote, "were not entitled to the same levels of shelter and subsistence," unquote. The earlier prisoners were supposedly covered by the Geneva and Hague Conventions, but who equivocates about dates when it is time to decide who is going to eat and who is going to starve? The Soviets had not signed any agreements regarding humanitarian treatment of prisoners of war. Therefore, they were not obligated to treat their prisoners humanely. The Allies intended to use the Germans as slave labor, also according to the Morgenthau Plan, and as discussed in Moscow in 1943 and at Yalta. On April 17, 1945, the U.S. opened Camp Rheinberg on the Rhine, about 6 miles wide in circumference. This was just one of several Rhine Meadow camps, actually just enclosures. Many opened in mid-April, Like the others, this one had no food, no buildings, no tents, no cooking facilities, no water, and no latrines, typical of the U.S. camps in Germany. Camp conditions caused rampant disease among the German prisoners, who suffered from exposure, overcrowding, and malnutrition. On April 21, 1945, Eisenhower sent another message to General Marshall, reporting that the new prisoner enclosures, and I quote, will provide no shelter or other comforts, unquote. The prisoners would be obligated to improve the enclosures with any available materials. However, there were no available materials. A later order prohibited the prisoners from erecting any kind of shelter at all. German prisoners often sought shelter by digging holes in the mud. The enclosures consisted of open fields surrounded by barbed wire known as prisoner of war temporary enclosures, complete with searchlights, guard towers, and men with machine guns. By the summer of 1945, the British and the U.S. had more than 6 million troops in their barbed wire enclosures. The Soviets had over 2 million. The open-air enclosures lacked even the barest facilities found in Nazi camps, which usually had kitchens, infirmaries, hospitals, latrines, and barracks. Auschwitz had two-story heated brick barracks with flush toilets. With no latrines, crowded, anxious inmates standing almost shoulder to shoulder by necessity often relieved themselves where they stood, which created a growing quagmire of contaminated, putrid mud. Latrines, actually ditches, where available, were abominable, perilous death traps for those who slipped. Food, water, and shelter, basic human necessities, were unavailable in the camps, per Eisenhower's orders. Excuse me. Although sufficient food resources, tents, blankets, were available in the Army's supply depots. I'm sorry. On April 22, 1945, the U.S. had, in Europe, 50 days worth of 4,000 calorie rations to feed 5 million people and other lower calorie rations for an additional 50 days. They had the food. They just chose not to give it. Author James Bach wrote, and I quote, "In April 1945, hundreds of thousands of German soldiers, as well as the sick from hospitals, amputees, women's auxiliaries, and civilians were caught. One inmate at Rheinberg was over 80 years old. Another was aged 9. Nagging hunger and agonizing thirst were their companions, and they died of dysentery. A cruel heaven pelted them week after week with streams of rain. Amputees slithered like amphibians toward the mud, soaking and freezing, naked to the skies day and night, and day after day, night after night. They lay desperate in the sand of Rheinberg, or slept exhaustedly into eternity in their collapsing holes." Unquote. George Weiss, a survivor, reported that the absence of water was the worst thing of all. And he said, and I quote, "For 3.5 days we had no water at all. We would drink our own urine. It tasted terrible, but what could we do?" Unquote. The U.S. military would not allow the International Committee of the Red Cross to come within the barbed wire enclosures as permitted by the Geneva Conventions. The U.S. military, per Eisenhower's instructions, did not allow prisoners to receive mail or packages. On April 26, 1945, the combined chiefs of staff in Washington cabled Eisenhower their approval of the disarmed enemy forces status for all German citizens, only in U.S. captivity. Everybody was considered an enemy, whether they had fought or not. By April 30th, 1945, there was an additional 2,062,865 of these civilian prisoners. The British refused to apply the DEF status to the German prisoners under their jurisdiction. British Army Field Marshal Viscount Montgomery said, and I quote, "The German food cuts have come to stay. We will keep them at 1,000 calories. Britons get 2,800. They gave the inmates of Belsen only 800. The minimum adult calorie intake to sustain minimal health is 1,800 to 2,250 for a sedentary individual. Prisoners under Eisenhower's authority were supposed to get 2,000 calories per day, but in most cases they received much less than even half of that amount, probably around 500 calories per day if they got any at all. According to the Geneva Conventions, all prisoners of war should receive the same rations as the occupying military force. This was applicable to all prisoners, those who voluntarily surrendered or the hundreds who were rounded up in the bombed-out cities. U.S. soldiers got 4,000 calories per day. The U.S. military housed some of the Germans, not categorized as DEFs, like scientists and other professionals, in choice locations where they received adequate food and shelter. On May 8, 1945, Germany accepted an unconditional surrender as required by the Allies. On May 9th, Eisenhower's headquarters sent a form letter to all of the German cities and towns under his control, warning all citizens who were also starving against public gatherings or trying to provide food for the prisoners in the U.S. military enclosures. If the U.S. military witnessed any civilian giving food to the prisoners, they would shoot him or her. Apparently, U.S. military leaders considered feeding a prisoner a crime punishable by death. According to witnesses, guards at U.S. camps shot and killed several women who had attempted to deliver food to prisoners who were probably family members. Thousands of ordinary soldiers and citizens perished from dysentery, diarrhea, typhoid fever, tetanus, and septicemia, all related to overcrowding, lack of sanitation, and malnourishment, in numbers unheard of since the Middle Ages. Others perished from cardiac disease and pneumonia. Experts attribute about 9.7 to 15% of the deaths to reasons exclusively associated to malnourishment, like emaciation, dehydration, and sheer exhaustion. Thousands ultimately died, no matter what the medical corps officers wrote, simply because Eisenhower's military minions incarcerated them in the hellish enclosures. Each day, mass burials took place in each enclosure. Between May 1st and June 15th, 1945, the death rate was 80 times higher than anything they had ever witnessed. By the end of May, just 1 month, more people died in the U.S. enclosures than in the bombing of Hiroshima, which 140,000 people died. Eisenhower imposed strict censorship after victory in Europe Day, May 8th, 1945. More so then, when the battle still raged. Newspapers in the U.S. did not report anything about Eisenhower's camps, especially not in the New York Times, who even admitted on May 27th, and I quote, "The American people are being deprived of information to which they are entitled," unquote. Well, things haven't changed a bit now, have they? General Eisenhower of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force controlled over, get this, 200 barbed wire enclosures in Northwest Europe that incarcerated 5,224,310 by June 1945. The worst of the U.S. temporary enclosures were the Rhine Meadow camps, such as Bad Kreuznach, I'm going to butcher these words, Rumegen, Sinzig, Reinberg, Heidensheim, Wickrathberg, and Buderich. All the enclosures were overcrowded, putrid, and disease-ridden. For instance, the capacity for camp number 18 was not to exceed 6 to 8,000 prisoners. However, there were 32,902 prisoners held there. At least 1,400,000 German prisoners failed to return to their homes following the war. Author Giles McDonough wrote that at least 1.5 million Germans died in those camps due to their ill treatment and starvation. In contrast, in 1945, the American Red Cross said that 99% of the U.S. POWs held in German camps had survived and were soon returning home. Information about these camps never appeared in any newspaper anywhere, then or now. The U.S. government sponsored subsidized and sanitized history books protecting their participation in the total destruction of Germany and many of its non-combatant people. Willy Brandt, U.S. puppet chancellor from 1969 to 1974 of the Federal Republic of Germany, through the West German Foreign Office, provided a long-term cover-up of U.S. atrocities. The U.S. maintained a strong presence in West Germany. In 1976, West Germany, one of six nations, helped found the Group of Six, G6. Martin Breck from Manhattan, New York, was an 18-year-old private first class in Company C of the 14th Infantry. In 1990, when he revealed his story after decades of silence, he was a professor of philosophy and religion at Mercy College in New York. In 1945, his superiors assigned him to as a guard and interpretator at Eisenhower's death camp at Andernach along the Rhine River. Brecht relates that the U.S. detained about 50,000 prisoners of various ages just at Andernach on the Rhine River in Rhineland-Palatinate, Germany, in an open field enclosed by barbed wire. They kept women in separate open-air enclosures. The prisoners had no coats, blankets, or any visible shelter. They were compelled to sleep on the ground, often muddy, wet, and cold. They used a trench for human waste. Rations consisted of a thin, watery soup to which the emaciated prisoners added grass and weeds to ease their hunger pains. Prisoners weakened by persistent dysentery often lay in their own excrement. The U.S. military had sufficient food and medical supplies. Brecht, sympathetic to the suffering of the prisoners, was outraged at the indifference of the camp guards. He questioned his superior officers, and they told him they were under strict orders from higher up. The majority of the other guards did not share Brecht's compassion for the prisoners. Most viewed the Germans as subhuman who deserved whatever happened to them, even a torturous death. The U.S. government had produced massive amounts of anti-German propaganda to indoctrinate the troops. Guards had read the racist articles and publications such as The Stars and Stripes, a GI newspaper filled with reports and graphic photos about the German concentration camps. This inflamed some kind of self-righteous indignation that eased their own perpetration of the very same behavior they vehemently denounced. The prisoners were mostly civilians, farmers, working men, many of whom languished into a lethargic state of listlessness. Some prisoners, in a desperate suicidal hopelessness, attempted to escape by climbing the barbed wire, knowing the guards would immediately shoot them. On May 8, 1945, the end of the war, U.S. soldiers expected that they were going to return home. However, that was not the case, for now the occupation began. Camp Andernach, referred to as a killing field, quote-unquote killing field, was now part of the French zone. The U.S. military transferred German prisoners formerly under its jurisdiction to the French military authorities. The military force-marched the prisoners to another camp. Those who could not keep up the pace and fell behind were bludgeoned and rolled to the side of the road where their bodies were later collected by a truck. By the end of 1946, the U.S. military had emptied most of its camps. The French continued to hold prisoners until 1949. Between 1947 and 1950, the U.S. government destroyed the majority of the incriminating records regarding the U.S. prison camps. The Germans maintained that more than 1,700,000 soldiers who were determined as living at the end of the war, May 8, 1945, never returned home. The Allies refute all responsibility for the atrocities committed against the German prisoners, but are quick to blame the Soviets for all inhumane abuses within all of the camps. According to the Congressional Record of January 29, 1946, Eisenhower said, and I quote, "While I and my subordinates believe that stern justice should be meted out to war criminals by proper legal procedure, we would never condone inhumane or un-American practices upon the helpless, which is one of the crimes for which those war criminals must now stand trial." Unquote. On September 27, 1948, Eisenhower was awarded an honorary humanities degree by the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in New York City. The audience applauded his efforts in ending the Nazi terror and honored him for his military accomplishments and for the high moral standards that he demonstrated and for his, and I quote, "statesmanship, tolerance, and humaneness," unquote. They congratulated him as, and I quote, "a soldier of intellectual integrity with a love for peace and his fellow man, a beloved counselor of our people in peace as in war," unquote. In his acceptance speech, he acknowledged his conviction of what Americans believe in, regardless of, and I quote, "race or creed." He said, and I quote, "Our army fights to defend our way of life, freedom for each of us to worship God in his own way," unquote. He said that ancient Jewish leaders, and I quote, "gave birth to the doctrines that the American army fought to defend." I wonder if he's talking about those in the Book of Esther. He concluded, "all the world is the seed of Abraham," unquote. So I hope that gives you kind of a different viewpoint of Eisenhower, and I hope that you will investigate this on your own.
For many years now, the Rhine-Meadows Memorial Society has organized an annual march in honor of the victims who were captured, degraded, tortured, and murdered along the banks of the Rhine River following the so-called liberation by the Allies on May 8th. 1945. This year, the group focused on the evidence collected from years of investigations into these crimes in order to raise public awareness. Many thousands of informational flyers were handed out to citizens at information booths which they had organized. The group also had to wage a legal battle against the local city authorities who had banned the march, and they were successful. Finally, on March 19, 2011, in the city of Remagen, the march organized by the Rhine-Meadows Memorial Society proceeded. Around 300 people gathered in various locations where the World War II Allies had committed these atrocities, both to remind the victors of their crimes and also to pay their respects and to give honor to the untold numbers of victims of these atrocities. It is said that a folk, a people, is only worth as much as the honor honor it bestows upon its fallen. This phrase drew the ire of left-wing extremists who had arrived and attempted to disrupt and provoke the marchers, attacking them as well as police officers who were trying to keep the peace, pelting them with bottles and other projectiles, but they did not prevent the march. As the marchers, all dressed in black, arrived from all across Germany, they gathered at the various locations, including at a chapel which was built in 1978 in honor of the German prisoners of war. They then proceeded to march, maintaining a high level of discipline, and all conducted themselves honorably. There were numerous speakers who spoke to those who were in attendance and who described the nature of the crimes that were committed and how shamefully the American army had treated their captives, and they eulogized the victims. 1 million soldiers were killed at this location, and we now seek justice for these crimes. It is our sacred duty to honor the victims and to never forget them. And moreover, to build our future in full consciousness of these victims, of the cold-blooded victors. And we must not be distracted or persuaded to forget them, but to always give honor to those who fought for us and paid with their personal sacrifices and their blood for our freedom and our fatherland.
Den sie bezahlten mit ihrem Leben, den Traum, den sie heute an uns weitergeben.
The first speaker at the memorial service was Sven Lobeck. He gave a detailed description of the crimes and atrocities that were committed against the German prisoners. He said, "Many years in advance, the Allies had devised this plan, and they conspired to murder as many Germans as they could. One million German victims were murdered in the Rhine Meadows death camps." Next, Ralph Tegethoff spoke, and he stated clearly that these death camps had been built after the capitulation, which, so we are told, had ended the war, and as such, they made a total mockery of the surrender and of themselves and their stated intentions for waging that war. He said, "We have received an order. This order came from no man nor woman. This order came from our conscience to come here and to participate here today. We are the product of 3,000 continuous years of German civilization and history. We stand here upon sacred German soil. We stand here along the Rhine, and we give honor to all those who, in two world wars, sacrificed their lives, their blood, their limbs, and health for the perpetuation of the German folk. And we now conduct ourselves as honorable soldiers. And in so doing, we are at one with those who went before us." Also in attendance, as an honored guest, was one of the few remaining survivors, Lieutenant Katte, who described his life as a soldier and finally paid his respects to his fallen brothers and sisters. Finally, the leader of the NPD party in the state of Rhineland-Palatinate, Dorothy Armistoff, spoke, and she read a poem as two members of the procession laid a wreath in honor of the victims. In her closing words, she said, "Now, let us swear, each of us here, to you, our fallen ones, you fought for our folk, and we will remember it always." At the end of the ceremony, there was a roll call for each of the names of the historical German armies and their various branches dating back hundreds of years through to the Second World War as well as the civilian victims of the Allied terror bombing campaign, the German expellees who were driven from their homes. And all of the civilian victims of the Allied post-war policies of extermination of the German people. The attendees then solemnly filed out in three rows and continued their peaceful march. They ignored all of the provocations from other groups who had gathered to demonstrate against them, continued on with their march, observing total silence. At another location in the city, several other activists spoke to those who had gathered there, one from Dortmund, one from Wuppertal, and another from the Rhine-Main region. Sven Skoda was the last speaker, and he said that they had gathered there on that day to speak out, to break the silence, to challenge the lies, to honor the victims and honor our own people, our traditions and history. In closing, he said that only the truth can set us free. He added, there are still Germans alive today, including young people, who now proclaim that I would rather die than to live in this system under silence and lies. From there, the march continued, back to the train station where they had begun, where the day's events officially came to a close, successfully concluding the 2011 march. Neither provocations nor lies from the mainstream media could prohibit that on the streets of Remagen, a better Germany could be displayed here for all to see. 1 million victims called us here today to speak for them. 1 million victims will see to it that we are here again next year. Germans from all over our country will be back to do it again. One million German victims beg for truth and justice.